thank Judy and Marty for singing for us. We trust the Lord will bless that word and song and teaches everyone the wonderful meaning of it, of living in union and identification with the Lord Jesus Christ. I have a special announcement and a special request that may be something possible, it may not. So I want all the men, especially the men who sing in the choir, and those who maybe can't be here Sunday morning but could form part of that group, I would like you to hang on for a few minutes tonight. I mean, stay behind. I have had a special request from a lady. Now, one thing you learn in my job, stay on the right side of the women. Ever since I was a student minister, I always believed I could hold my own with a man any day, but I sure don't want to cross a woman unnecessarily. But anyway, this is a very gracious request. I'm only joking that lady, and she'll know it. But I was asked this morning if I couldn't get the men to form a group as they did before next Sunday evening, which is the nearest Sunday evening to Reformation Day, to have them sing as they did before the Psalm 76 to the tune that is noted in the hymn book or in the psalm book. It's almost impossible for a congregation to sing. When a congregation tries to sing it, we would say in Northern Ireland, it's like the tune the owl cow died with. Now, there's a fellow there from Northern Ireland, and he'll understand exactly what that means. But it's a wonderful tune. And when a group of men sing it, it is particularly good. And I have been asked that they would get a little practice in tonight. Now, I don't really want to start calling out Byron and Danny Verdon and Tim Farr and his son, and no, not Mike Barrett, his son, and Gene Elliott and David Stair. Well, you know all the rest. Those of you who sing in the choir, you men, and those of you who could or should, we want you to do your best for this. A group of about, well, how many? The more men, the better. Because next week, as this is sung, I'm going to take 2 or 3 minutes again at this request to tell the story from Scottish covenanting history when the Scottish covenanters sang this psalm and to this tune. And you can just imagine the scene when you hear it and as you hear the singing. So we're looking forward to that. So I don't know if Dr. Gingery will need a whip or whatever, but we do want the men to do their best to take 5 or 10 minutes after the service. You're all great singers. You don't need a lot of practice. And this is something I think you'll enjoy doing and the people will enjoy hearing. Let me just say something for your encouragement also. We are studying these Lord's Day evenings, the idea of the Reformation and revival. And so that what I'm doing this year is not anything very particular in one special part of the Reformation story, but taking more sweeping views of it to see it in connection with revival to encourage our own hearts that God is able to do a great work in our day. So often, we are so tied in to what is happening around us that we lose all vision of what the Lord is doing. If you were here Wednesday night, I'm sure you went home with your heart thrilled. And if you weren't here, the Lord help you, because you missed a great meeting. We had a brother from China here, a man who for many years suffered intensely, thrown into labor camps, etc., by the atheistic communists, but to see his friends murdered and butchered because of their stand for Christ. And he's now working among the Chinese, some of them in Clemson University. He's working with them there, seeing a good number of them saved, and the work going on, working with Chinese people in various parts, and hoping very soon to be able to get back into mainland China with the gospel of the Lord Jesus. He was telling us that the figures that are turned out by the government, they may not be the most accurate, but if they're not accurate, they'll be accurate. They'll be inaccurate in the sense that they downplay what has happened. But according to those figures from the government of Red China, whereas when the atheists took over, there were reputed to be 1 million evangelical Protestants in all of China. Today, they reckon there are 63 million believers. Now, when you stop to let that sink in, you realize it's a small number in comparison to 1,200 million. It's a very small number. The mathematicians will give you the exact percentage. But somewhere possibly in the region of 5% of the population, not very many, but a great number of souls nonetheless. The Lord has been doing a work in various places we don't know a lot about. And so many parts of the world that are remote from us that it does us good now and again just to get our eyes off the immediate circumstance in which we're placed and realize that the work of God is an ongoing work. Can we see again in America, in places like England and other Western nations, can we see God move to the saving of many souls? Sure we can. Sure we can. God has power to save. And if we get nothing else out of the Reformation Month studies, if that gets through to our heart, to set us on fire to pray and labor, then it will all be very well worthwhile. Now tonight we're turning for our Bible reading to Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1. Last week I looked at the Reformation as a picture of the revival we need. I want us to focus a little more sharply in that picture tonight and see the Reformation, or see in the Reformation, the power of the revival we need. Romans chapter 1, we'll commence reading at verse 14. I am debtor both to the Greeks and to the barbarians, both to the wise and to the unwise. So, as much as in me is, I am ready to preach the gospel to you that are at Rome also. For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation, to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek. For therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness, because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God hath showed it unto them. For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. For the sake of time, we'll finish the reading at verse 21. The Lord will add his own blessing to the reading of his word for his name's sake. On such a subject as seeing in the Reformation the power of the revival that we need to see in our day, Romans 1:16 is an obvious text. I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek. The Protestant Reformation was a many-faceted movement. There have been very many purported explanations for its origin and its progress. Back in the days of Martin Luther, there was one Roman Catholic theologian who attributed it all to the malign influence and force of astrology. The Protestant Reformation got off to such a strong beginning, and it continued so strongly because the stars happened to be lined up in a peculiarly anti-papal stance. Well, I'm sure there wasn't much truth in the astrological method, but I'm always glad when the stars in their courses fight against the Lord's enemies, as they did against Sisera of old. Then there were others, and this has been a very widely held view. There were others who simply dismissed the Protestant Reformation as an insurrection, an illegal rebellion against legally constituted and God-ordained authority. Some saw it as a new phase in an ancient conflict, the conflict between the emperors and the popes. If you read the history of Europe, you'll find that there was always that tension, always that struggle between the state power and the church power. One headed up in the emperor, the Holy Roman Empire, the other headed up in the person of the Roman pontiff. And so people have dismissed the Reformation as just another phase in that ongoing conflict. Some lament that the Reformation ever took place because, they say, it was the end, the death of the Renaissance. That revival of letters which brought Europe back to its cultural foundations. That revival of letters which could spawn such brilliant intellects as Erasmus, who could take his satire and use it to poke fun at the sins and wickedness of Romanism, but yet would expand the horizons of man by the great studies of the humanism of that day. The Reformation took over the Renaissance to a large degree. It is not totally unfair to say that at least for a time it spelt death to the Renaissance. I think that was a good thing. In other words, it didn't take the revival of letters and let them be wasted in nothing more important than what I would call cartoon or comedy philosophy. But it channeled the thoughts of men into the deepest theology and used their learning for something that was eternally worthwhile. Of course, it is only true to say that the Renaissance got its own back with a vengeance in the days of the so-called, miscalled Enlightenment, when darkness came again in the place of the light of gospel truth. Then there are others, and they have made the Reformation just a transition between medievalism and rationalism, because it gave vent to the spirit of free inquiry, that it therefore led to modern rationalism. Now you get all these ideas. I'm not going to discuss them tonight. But they all go together to prove how very difficult it is to explain from a natural point of view the origin and the progress of the Reformation. You see, what that Reformation was, and what the natural mind finds it so difficult to come to terms with, can only be appreciated when it is seen as a truly magnificent spiritual revival. When you read the history of those times, and it's not all, I have to be right up front and say this, I haven't time to pursue this idea at this time, but it's not all wonderful. It wasn't the golden age. Not everything that the reformers did, said, or believed was right. Not every stand they took is the stand that we would take today, or that we could justify. It was not all 100% perfect. Nothing that man has a hand in is 100% perfect. We all should know that. So I don't want you to get such a lopsided view as you think that the reformers were just angels in Middle Ages garb. They were not. They were men with all the faults and the feelings and the limitations of men. But the Reformation was a time when the Lord powerfully visited his people. It was a time when, as never before since the day of Pentecost, the simple but stupendous truths of the gospel formed the course of public events and changed the history of the world forever. The Reformation was essentially a religious movement. It was essentially a spiritual event, a spiritual revival. But, and this is something that too often is not taken into consideration, it did not occur in a vacuum. In other words, the God who sent this great revival was the very same God who was moving mightily in the historical happenings of those times. And it was in God's time that this great Reformation was sent. And as ever, his timing was perfect. Just at that particular juncture in history, the world was moving from its medieval phase into the modern phase. Just at that particular point, man had come into a time of great inventions and great discoveries. When you stop to think of it, at that particular period, the magnetic compass was transforming the exploration of the seas and of the lands beyond the seas. Gunpowder, known to the Chinese long before, but not in Europe, gunpowder was changing the field of battle. It was the great leveler that made the meanest serf just as great a soldier as the haughtiest knight. The invention of movable type printing meant that knowledge could be diffused more quickly, more easily than in all the history of the world. It was an age of great invention. It was an age of great discovery. Surely every American by this time knows that this year is the 500th anniversary of Columbus's journey to the New World. That was the era in which the Reformation took place. Vasco da Gama. I don't know if you learn much about Vasco da Gama in American schools, but I well remember, and I'm sure my wife, I see her smiling, she remembers it too. Vasco da Gama figured greatly in all that we had to learn as he sought and succeeded in finding a passage to India around the Cape of Good Hope. The explorations of John Cabot and then his son after him. These were times of great discovery. At that time, Copernicus overthrew the entire philosophy of the medieval world, overthrew the theology of the Roman Catholic Church, and taught very clearly something that again had been taught in ancient Greece, that the earth revolves around the sun, not the sun around the earth. As I've indicated, there was a great revival of letters. The Renaissance brought in this revival of learning. And these things all concurred in imbuing the minds of men with a desire for new and free inquiry. Now, it was against this backdrop, with the added ingredients of all the usual European tensions, the emperor fighting the pope, England and France and various other princes at each other's throat and trying to keep a tenuous balance of power. Against this backdrop, the Reformation burst upon the world. Now, none of the movements I have mentioned produced the Reformation. The Pope didn't produce it. The Emperor didn't produce it. The King of France didn't produce it. The King of England didn't produce it. Copernicus didn't produce it. Men like Erasmus certainly didn't produce it, so the Renaissance did not produce it. None of these movements in the world produced the Reformation, but what they did was that providentially they provided vehicles that aided and sometimes threatened to endanger the progress of this great movement of God. You see, God chooses his moment in history. How often it has been glibly said, and we just shrug it off, that history, to be properly understood, history should simply be split into two words. It's his story. And so it is. I am not a professional historian. In fact, I come to think of it, I don't think I'm a professional anything. Maybe that's a good thing. I don't know. But I'm not going to get into philosophies of history. But I can tell you this. The man who doesn't see that behind history there is the God of all history sees nothing. The man who only sees the great tides of movement in the affairs of men will never ascend any higher than a Karl Marx. You think of all the misery that his misrepresentation of history has brought upon the world. The man who can go no further than that is not seeing anything. History is his story. He's in control of it all. He chooses the time to move. And he assembles all the forces that are best adapted to aid that movement. And that's exactly what he did in the Reformation. No matter what men would try to do to bring it to naught, they could not stop its progress. Popes tried. The bishops tried. The princes tried. Battles were fought. Blood was shed. But at the end of it all, the work was of God. And they proved the text that we have taken tonight. The gospel is the power of God unto salvation. So I want us tonight to think of the Reformation as showing the power of the revival that we need today. Now I have the simplest possible outline, and it's a very brief outline of what I want to say. That does not, I hasten to add for the sake of visitors, mean that what I want to say is going to be necessarily brief. However, at least you'll remember the outline. I want us to think of this Reformation and the power of the revival we need. And when we look at the Reformation and God's movings in it, we're going to think of it first as a faith that saved. Secondly, we want to think of it then as a fire that spread. And finally, I want us to think of it as a force that succeeded. And when you think of those three things, you have, in essence, the powerful reviving that the Church of Christ needs today. Revival has to start with a revival in the realm of faith. And I'm talking now about faith in the sense of the substance of what is preached. We do not need a revival of any particular ism. We do not need a revival such as the charismatics are boasting about. We do not need a revival that merely adds people to something. They know not what, believing they know not what, and going they know not where. We need a revival of true biblical faith, a faith that saves. We need to see a revival that will be a fire lit by the hand of God, kindled by the love of God, energized by the Spirit of God, that will not be stopped by the enemies of God. We need to see a revival that will be a real force in personal, national, and international affairs. A real force, something that's not in the gutter of the political process, something that is from heaven and that impresses itself upon every political process. That's what we need in the day in which we're living. Now then, let's think then of the faith that saved. That's primarily what the Reformation was. You see, it was a gospel movement, and the gospel is the power of God. It wasn't Martin Luther who was the power of God. It wasn't John Calvin. It wasn't Lutheranism. It wasn't Calvinism. There were men before these who were also great thinkers and great preachers and great communicators. But they didn't see done what these men saw done. I have to recognize the sovereignty of God in that to a large extent. He chooses the man and the moment. But nonetheless, the fact of the matter is that Luther and Calvin and the others were used of God to do something that had never been done, at least in any widespread scale before, and that was to go beyond tampering with the immorality of the papacy, go beyond trying to snip off the worst excesses of the papacy, and go to the very root of the whole matter and realize that the gospel had to be rediscovered and re-preached and republished. So this was a gospel movement. Now, the gospel that they preached centered largely on the truth of justification by grace through faith in Jesus Christ. That's why I read from Romans chapter 1 tonight. You see, the faith of the Reformation. Now, you'll understand that the Reformation, in its doctrinal content, went way, way beyond this hard core of doctrine. Went away beyond it. And it accepted the Bible in all its fullness. But this is the message. I want you never to forget it, for this is the message we need today. This is the message that's not being preached today. What is it? Romans chapter 1. There are three things revealed in Romans chapter 1. The word revealed is used twice. The word manifested, a different word in English and in Greek, but nonetheless with a similar idea. Three things that are revealed. First of all, the knowledge of God is revealed and suppressed. You notice the end of verse 18. They hold the truth. The idea is they hold down. They suppress the truth in unrighteousness because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God hath showed it unto them. The first thing that is revealed is the knowledge of God. And that knowledge is suppressed. And there you've got the sin of man. The Reformers dealt largely with that truth. If you read the Institutes of John Calvin, you'll find that one of the great ideas that he pursues at the beginning of his Institutes is the knowledge of God the Creator. And how men in wickedness deny the law of their own being. What this is telling us is that really there are no honest, genuine atheists. Men have to deny themselves to deny God. Men have to make a mockery of their own natural constitution to deny God. In every living cell, God has given his signature. He has stamped his being. All men have the knowledge of God, but they suppress it, and that's their sin. Now then, there is revealed the righteousness of God, and the righteousness of God is salvation from sin. It is the righteousness provided in Jesus Christ, whereby man can have their sin pardoned, their souls brought into a reconciled state with God and be clothed in the perfect merits of Jesus Christ so that they're acceptable to God. That's the righteousness of God. That's salvation. That righteousness revealed and imputed was the heart of the Reformation message. But then the wrath of God is revealed. And it's inflicted, if you read on through the passage that we hadn't time to read tonight in Romans chapter 1, you'll find that the wrath of God revealed is actually inflicted. The wrath of God is already being inflicted. You read Romans 1, you'll find that when God gives people up, that's in wrath. I know that it has caused great controversy when any preacher has had the temerity to say that epidemics like the AIDS epidemic is the wrath of God. Now, we have to back up. We understand that people have contracted this in an innocent fashion. I know that fear My own sister has had her life kept in her body for years by multiplied blood transfusions. She has told me that every time she goes for a blood transfusion, she's very much aware of the scourge and the curse of tainted blood. And certainly, people have innocently been drawn in ways like that. And little children have been born and brought into the world already infected. We understand that. But nonetheless, at the heart, in this country, at the heart of that awful scourge is Romans chapter 1 and God's curse. God's curse on the perversion of sodomy. That's the wrath of God. It reaches nations. Reaches right out into the future. God's sentence on sin. Now, those were three great areas: sin, salvation, and judgment. The Reformation dealt with many other things, but that was the heart of the message. Men and women, could I tell you that that's the message that set Europe on fire? The greatest feature of the republication of the gospel was its converting power. You read of the conversion of Martin Luther. It's a thrilling story. If you've never read in detail the story of the conversion of Martin Luther, then I tell you, go to the library. Get down J.H. Merrill Dubonnet's History of the Reformation. Read the story of Luther's conversion. I say read it there because it's the best written history that I have ever read of Luther's conversion. Read Ronald Bainton's story of Luther's conversion, and if it doesn't thrill your heart, I don't know what will. Here is a man in the darkness of Romanism, his soul in turmoil, and the light of Romans 1:17 bursts upon his heart, and he's justified by faith, transformed from a groveling papist monk, afraid of his own shadow, into one of the mightiest monarchs of the pulpit the world has ever seen. That's God's salvation. You think of a man like Ulrich Zwingli, another Roman Catholic priest in Switzerland. An admittedly immoral man, living like all or almost all the rest of the priests, living in open sin, his life a scandal. Then God met him and God saved him. No longer was his life a scandal, but a life of dedicated sainthood. Man who was used in the initial stages to bring life and light and liberty to at least some of the Swiss cantons. I always love to think of how Hugh Latimer was saved. Hugh Latimer was an Englishman. He's one of the greatest characters in English history. Unique character. Latimer hated the gospel. He hated that gospel. If he could do anything to bring to naught the Reformation and establish popery again, he would have done it. And as a priest, he intended to use, he just had dedicated all his energies. He had given himself to the Pope to do this work. But God had other plans for Hugh Latimer. I think when I dealt with the English Reformation, I told you the story of how Thomas Bilney, little Bilney, decided he had a way to reach Hugh Latimer. And so one day he went and he said, "Could I make my confession to you?" And Latimer's heart was overjoyed. Here is one of the leading Protestants, and he's coming back into the fold. He's coming to make confession to me as his priest. And he was ready to hear the confession. And so he started. The confession came tumbling forth. Bilney confessed what a sinner he was. And he confessed what a Savior Christ was and the power of the blood of his atonement and the glory of his justifying grace. And it was the priest that day who got converted. And when Latimer heard face to face the glorious story of the gospel, the dark mind of the Roman Catholic priest became enlightened with the glory of the gospel of Christ. And Hugh Latimer became one of the greatest preachers England ever produced. A fearless man of God. I know I have given you Latimer's testimony before, but some of you are new here, and I want you to get a bit of fire in your belly as you leave this meeting tonight. I want to get a bit of backbone into some of us Christians. We're so easily put off. Latimer got saved and he wouldn't give up the truth for man, woman, or devil. For some reason or other, one of the greatest paradoxes in English history is the character of Henry VIII. Henry VIII liked Latimer. I think it was because Henry liked a man's man. He was fed up to the teeth with these effeminate, time-serving preachers and priests who would agree with God or agree with the devil as long as it lined their pocket, kept them safe. Latimer was not like that. One day, of course, you all know the story of Henry VIII. He was not quite the world's most faithful husband. One of the most dangerous occupations in the world was to be Henry VIII's wife. It added a whole new meaning to the idea of a woman losing her head. So Latimer stood before him and he preached as a court chaplain. Whoremongers and adulterers, God will judge. And Henry didn't like it. And so he was summoned before the king. And he was made to understand that the king did not appreciate personal preaching. Then he was appointed to preach again next week. Latimer knew rightly what it meant. So as he stood up to preach, the big word is he apostrophized. You know what that means? No. Well, I'm glad I'm not the only ignorant person here. He ignored the audience. He spoke to himself. But really, he was speaking to them. And if I could sum it up, I'm speaking from memory, so I'm not reading this and giving you word for word, but what he said was, Hugh Latimer, today you stand before His August Majesty, Henry VIII, the King of England. He has power to take off thy head. Be careful, Hugh Latimer. Be careful what you say. And of course, the king was happy. But then Latimer stood back and he said, But, Hugh Latimer, today you stand in the presence of a greater king than the King of England. You stand in the presence of Jesus Christ, the King of Kings, who can not only take off thy head, but cast thy soul into hell. Be careful, Hugh Latimer, what you preach. Then he announced his text. Whoremongers and adulterers, God will judge. And he kept both his head and his soul, though later burned at the stake by Bloody Mary. Yet Hugh Latimer could stand. Why? Because God had saved him. I could tell you the story of William Farrell. Actually, you should have been here Friday night. My wife would have told you the story of William Farrell. I was deeply disappointed. The world's greatest preacher, on one of the greatest subjects, William Farrell's testimony. And for some reason or other, it hadn't got around, and only a handful of people were here to hear Joan. So if you want to hear about William Farrell, talk to her. Another Roman Catholic priest, a brilliant young man with... some historians talk about Farrell as if he were just a country bumpkin. He was no country bumpkin. He had a fine intellect and a fine education, but he was a man who got saved, and the fire of God burned within him. Man, when Hugh Farrell got saved, first thing he did was went back to his family and he saw them saved. Went back to his home village and he saw that village greatly moved and greatly saved. Started moving around all the villages and the towns round about. Many a time he would go into a Roman Catholic chapel. He was a priest after all. And man, when he came in, the priest trembled. Here he was with his red hair, quick temper, quick tongue. A little man, not a very fearsome character as far as physical attributes went, but he had got the fire of God within him. And many a time when Farrell went in, he would just push the priest aside and start preaching. There were occasions when the priest got saved and the whole congregation got saved. See the converting power of the gospel? John Calvin tells about when God saved him, there was the transformation from darkness to light. There was that mighty moment when God changed this erudite Frenchman, probably the greatest intellect in the world in his day, maybe of most other days. God suddenly met with him, changed his life from the life of a reclusive scholar into a mighty evangelist and a mighty theologian. To change the world for God. All these men. I could go on and tell you of John Knox. I daren't do that for I love. I'm getting to home territory when I get to Knox. You see, I'm getting to Scottish Presbyterianism. And for the sake of you good Baptists, I could tell you about Dr. Hubmaier. Hubmaier was a Roman Catholic priest. He became an Anabaptist. But Hubmaier was saved, became a mighty preacher of the gospel. I think of George Blaurock, again, a Roman Catholic, saved. I don't agree with all the Anabaptists said and did. Someday I'll get around to dealing with the divisions in the Reformation, and that would be one of them. Some historians make them all bad, some historians make them all good. The truth is that they were neither. They were neither all bad nor all good. But these were men who had a personal experience of salvation. They started to preach and they saw thousands saved. Thousands of people were saved. What you had was a faith that really saved sinners. You think of yourself as a peasant in Europe. As I said last week, a European peasant in those ages in many ways was worse off than an American slave last century. And that is not in any way to underestimate what it was to be a slave in America. It's never good to be any slave anywhere. But the European serfs were slaves of the worst kind. Think of them. As they heard the gospel, they had been ground under tyrannical heels for generations. Now they heard the gospel and they burst the cage of their imprisonment and thousands of them were gloriously converted to Christ. The middle classes were greatly moved. The merchant classes, one of the wonderful things, one of the stories of the Reformation is how God moved in. You think of England especially and Holland, and he moved into the merchant classes and he touched men in strategic positions. You had printers. Some of them got converted, some of them didn't. But even those who didn't were used to print up the gospel. Many of the merchants used their fleets and their contacts and their storage space to make sure the gospel was brought into their land. And then was distributed, no matter what the law of the land said, getting out the gospel. You see, this was a faith that saved. The point I'm making, the power of the Reformation depends on that. It's this hard core of doctrine. I'll deal next week more fully with the doctrinal content of the Reformation. But I want you to get this, that it was the truth that set man free. It was the truth. We have in America today a supposed revival going on. We are told about the millions of Americans who are born again Christians. According to some polls, some 40% of all Americans are born again Christians. But yet at the same time, those same people have lower moral standards. Doesn't really add up, does it? Increasing numbers of those saved and increasing numbers of those living in adultery and fornication and wickedness. There's something wrong with that kind of religion. Many of these people born again, but when you actually look at what they believe and what they do, their definition of the new birth and the Bible's definition of the new birth are two vastly different things. We certainly need today a return to the heart of the gospel. A gospel that has converting power. We need to recognize it is not some psychological gimmick that gets people saved. It's not the nice music in a service that lures people up the aisle that's going to get them into heaven. Oh, we have had too much of all the gimmickry that has filled church pews for a while, but unfortunately is similarly filling up the caverns of hell. We need a return to a message. A message. The heart of the gospel. Sin, salvation, and judgment. My friend, when you start preaching that kind of gospel and expounding the glories of God's grace in Jesus Christ, that's the message that God is going to honor. That is the faith that saves. But this Reformation, very quickly, was a fire that spread. Again, you'll see the hand of God in this. The Reformation has about it something that I covet and that I pray for day by day when I cry to God for revival. You've heard me, especially in prayer meetings, use the expression that we need a work that has none of the fingerprints of man upon it. We need a work that is not contrived. It is not manufactured. It's not the result of some meeting of men that have been able to come up with a master plan as to what is best to do. We need a work that is heavenly in its origin and that is heavenly in its progress, where men are swept along, not manipulating, but themselves used by the hand of God. The Reformation started simultaneously in Germany and in Switzerland. There is, to my knowledge, no organic link between what God was doing in Germany with Luther and what God was doing in Switzerland with Zwingli. He was doing one thing there and the same thing there. That's of God. Of course, that is nothing unusual. When you think of the great revival here in America in the 1850s, in 1857, God was moving upon people here in America. He was burdening them to pray. He was getting their hearts ready for a mighty outpouring of the Spirit. When that revival broke out, there were people came over from my little country in Northern Ireland, from the Presbyterian Church, to look at it, to understand, because they also had been burdened. And you know what they found? They found that at the very time when God started to move in 1857 here in America, in 1857 in Northern Ireland, he was moving people with the same burden in the same direction to the same ends. The 1850s saw a mighty outburst of fire here in America, And in Northern Ireland, they saw the greatest revival our country had ever seen. 100,000 souls saved in 1 year in a little country. It's not much bigger than Greenville County. 100,000 souls saved in 1 year. Churches built. God doing the same thing in both places. So that's what he did in the Reformation. Started in Germany and Switzerland, but he didn't stop there. Wasn't long localized. This was a fire. It spread. And it spread mighty quickly. I'm thankful it spread to England. I bless God that it spread to Scotland, because from Scotland it spread to Northern Ireland. From Northern Ireland and Scotland, ultimately, that great fire was brought to America. To a large degree, the strongest part, and this is not being jingoistic, but the strongest part of the working of God in this country could be traced to what God brought in from Scotland and Northern Ireland. So, it spread to the Netherlands. The Dutch Reformation is a thrilling story. It spread into the Scandinavian countries. It spread into the Slavonic countries. It even spread into Spain and into Italy. And it certainly spread into France. Every one of these places felt the vital power of the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. But the thing that I want to emphasize is, it was not a contrived spread. It was not something that man manufactured. What happened really was, especially at Wittenberg, there was a center of learning. There was a center of revival fire. Luther was in his prime. People came to be taught by him. People came to hear. And as they came to Wittenberg, they got the fire. And they went back to wherever they came from. And they brought the fire with them. Oh, what a spread it was. Not contrived by man, but fanned by God. It was often a controversial spread. It raised great passions. It was attended even by bloody battles. Never think that revival is a time when there's no controversy. There'd be greater controversy when we're in revival than at any time when we're not in revival. After all, there are not too many fights in a graveyard, unless you go there to fight, but the inhabitants of the graveyard don't get into too many fights. And when you've got death written upon the church, well, you can live happily together. That's what's wrong in the ecumenical movement. Sure, an apostate Presbyterian, and an apostate Methodist, and an apostate Baptist, and an apostate Romanist, they can all get together. They're dead from the neck up when it comes to spiritual things. They're dead. They don't need to fight. But man, when you've got life and the power of God, the devil's going to fight it. Happened in the Reformation. It's happened in every revival since. But no matter about the opposition and the controversy, nothing could stop the fire that was spreading in Europe. My friend, I want to tell you, that's the kind of power we need today. The fire. How often we have thought of revival under the symbol of fire. In Acts chapter 2, it was a tongue of fire that came. A fire that spreads, that becomes a mighty conflagration, that can burn up the opposition in its way. A fire that purifies. The fire of revival. Oh, let's be earnest in prayer about that. We have so many manufactured counterfeits. I have often quoted the words of G. Campbell Morgan. They were addressed to preachers who were simulating passion in the pulpit, but they will certainly apply to the whole church. He said, "Painted fire never burns." There are preachers who can simulate tears, simulate passion, simulate love, simulate anything. It's just like painted fire. It may look like the real thing, but you'd wait a long time for it to boil a kettle of water. It burns none. That's what's happening, sadly, in the manufactured revivals. What we have today is man largely, and I say today, I mean in our society, for thank God it's not like this all over the world. But we have man glorifying himself, so proud of what he has done. This is the day in America of the mega church. A mega church that is mega in every area except in gospel truth and gospel experience. My friend, we need fire. Where does it start? Well, where did it start in the Reformation? It started in the heart of one man in Germany. That's not to say nobody was burdened before him. There were men in whom God was doing a preparatory work. But ultimately we can say the fire started in the heart of one man in Germany, started in the heart of another man in Switzerland. And then it started to spread, touched another here, another there, it swept through villages, it moved through entire countries. My friend, that's the power of revival. All that God would give us a burden for a work that God starts and man can't stop. That leads me to the final thought of the Reformation as a force that succeeded. I haven't time to preach on this, so I'm going to just summarize what it succeeded in doing. Obviously, from what I have been saying, it succeeded in bringing thousands of souls to Christ. It succeeded in saving, ultimately, millions. That's the revival we want. That's the force. The successful moving of the Spirit of God saving sinners. Can God's people be indifferent to the salvation of sinners? Can God's church be indifferent to the whole idea of God moving to save sinners? The revival's success was the success of God's salvation. That's what we need today. But further than that, it succeeded in exposing and opposing Rome's deeply entrenched apostasy. Now you've got to understand, it's very difficult from the position of a modern day American to understand this. Coming from Ireland, I can have a better understanding of it because in many ways to this day, and certainly until very, very recently, we had just over the border into the south of Ireland, we had an up-to-date experience of the total control of Romanism over every part and particle of human existence in the south of Ireland. But in the Reformation's time, Rome was apparently immovable. It's not that there were no people who wanted to change it. Royal power couldn't overthrow the power of Rome. Kings had to give way. I've already in another study, a year or two back, described to you the humiliation of the English King John. When he had to bow to the Pope, because in those days, remember, the Pope simply, if a king displeased him too much, he put the entire nation ruled by that king under interdict. That meant that there could be no blessing of God to the for the forgiveness of sins, for the celebration of the sacrament, for the burial of the dead, for the release of souls from purgatory, we may stand back and say, no man has that power. But in those days, that was the most powerful force on earth. The power of the papal interdict brought kings crumbling before the foot of the Roman pontiff. Roman royal power field. Political intrigue couldn't overthrow the papacy. International wars couldn't break the yoke of the Pope's bondage. The brilliant satire of men like Erasmus and all the cultured barbs of the humanists. They may have irritated Rome for a little, but they utterly failed to expose and oppose the apostasy of Rome. There were people inside the Roman Catholic Church who attempted to purify it. In fact, right in the middle of the Reformation period, there was one pope who reigned just for about 18 months. Adrian, I think, number 6, if my memory's not too far wrong, who admitted that Luther's charges were correct, that the church in the city of Rome was a scandal, and that it needed to be reformed. He died rather suddenly. Nobody can prove it, just as with John Paul I, who also had ideas about certain things that needed to be changed in the Vatican. I don't know if you knew it or not. John Paul I was found dead the very night before the morning in which he was to deal with some of those things. That's what happened to Adrian. Many people said he was poisoned. I can't say that he was poisoned. I don't know. But I do know that the attempts to purify the church from the inside all failed. But the Reformation succeeded. Why? Because it came to the heart of the matter. It dealt with the doctrine of God. It dealt with the doctrine of grace. And it led men to view the glory that was theirs in Christ. I want to tell you, my friend, that was a force informed and inbred by the power of God. It succeeded in opposing the apostasy. Then the third thing it succeeded in doing, and this is what we need today. We need a work that has success in saving souls. We need a work that has success in opposing apostasy. We need a work then, thirdly, like the Reformation, because it succeeded in forming public opinion and policy in many, many places. The first dawn of freedom for millions came with the Reformation. The Church's declaration of independence of the state, spiritual independence of the state. I'm not talking about the Pope's ideas of its legal independence of all earthly power. The first draft of man's charter of rights for all men to be treated as God's creatures with equal dignity under just laws. The first statement of the right of free inquiry, though not with a license to blaspheme, not to proceed into anarchy. All this came with the Reformation. And yet it wasn't a political movement. Now, this is what I want you to understand, because this is what Americans today, American Christians, are finding so hard to balance. I sat in, I've told you this many a time, but it's very much to the point now. I sat in a meeting of fundamental leaders from all over the United States some years ago, and they were on the verge of putting in writing that they opposed legislated morality. You can't legislate morality. I couldn't believe that they would come to that conclusion. I nudged the fellow beside me, who would be well known to you if I were to name him to you. I nudged him, I said, speak up. He said, you had the thought, you speak up. But I'm a foreigner here, you speak up. Go ahead. Well, being very timid, I am. I ultimately had to speak up. I mean, you either legislate morality or immorality. There's nothing in between. There is no such thing as an amoral position. It doesn't exist. You either legislate righteousness or unrighteousness. Nothing wrong with legislated morality. To that degree, Jerry Falwell's moral majority was right. Where it was wrong was imagining that when you legislate morality, you make people Christian. That you suddenly have revival. That this getting of the church involved with everybody on the broadest base of morality is suddenly a great move of God. In the Reformation days, they knew better. They weren't, like some people wanted them to be, many Anabaptists, for example, and many people today, they weren't isolated from the political process. Thank God most fundamentalists are realizing you can't be isolated from the political process and lie then, after that, lie down and whimper. Things are not going the way you want them to go. But neither were they sucked up by it. Luther was a peasant. He was a serf's son. But when the peasants revolted, they took the gospel to mean that they could rise up in bloody rebellion. Luther agreed with the points that they were demanding, and he exhorted the princes to give them their just dues. But when they took the sword and they sought to turn the Reformation into a bloody socialist movement, he opposed them. I'm not going to say that he was right in his opposition. Down the line, I think at times he reacted too strongly. But nonetheless, he would not be sucked up to make this spiritual movement a political movement. Calvin and Knox took the same view. What a lesson for Christians today. I get sick. I must say I take it as an insult. Not only to my limited intelligence, but I take it as an insult to God. The way every panhandling politician, especially, America seems to be unique in this, comes spouting scripture at election time. And you'll get Christians that are sucked up into the political movement. Let me tell you, I have political views. It's not my job to preach that. I want to tell you, when any church, or when the Church of Christ generally, sells its soul to a political party or a political movement, it loses out with God. As many of you, as individuals, can work for good people running for office on a good platform, to do what you feel the Bible would have them do. I have no fight with that. But never tie the Church of God to any political movement or platform. Rather, let those platforms and people feel the power of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And then the final thing. This is a big, big statement that I'm only making and then leaving. Ultimately, the success of the Reformation can perhaps best be seen in one thing. Think of it. The nations that accepted it were blessed and they prospered beyond all you could ever think. The nations that rejected it paid a terrible price. Germany, where it accepted the Reformation. The Netherlands. I'm not being anti-Dutch, but the Netherlands, for such an apparently insignificant little country, have had an immense influence on the development of the modern world, not least this part of the modern world. So much of the theological purity that we retain in America, not saying we retain a lot of it, but so much of it is directly attributable to the influence of Dutch theology. The Dutch have been greatly used and greatly blessed. Many a time when I look at a map of the world and I see a little country like England, people wonder why England is now a second or third rate power. You know, the amazing thing is that England ever ruled the world, and she did. Look at it on a map. It's hardly the size of your thumbnail. That insignificant little place. But that insignificant little place has done more under God to bless this world. It hasn't been an unalloyed blessing, that I admit. But it has done more to bless this world than any nation on earth. And never forget it. And I'm not an Englishman. Never forget it. Why? Because England was taken out of the prison house of Romanism and superstition and was brought into the liberty of the gospel of Jesus Christ. What a wonderful blessing. You think of a little country like Scotland. When the gospel reached Scotland, it was one of the most backward, barbarian countries on earth. The contribution of Scotland to world development, especially Western world development, is out of all proportion to its size or resources, power of the gospel. But you take a country like Italy, where the gospel was ultimately rejected. What bloody conflicts and wars before the papal stranglehold could be broken and Italy would be united, but it was yet united in dark. You take a country like Spain, the Spain of Isabella and Ferdinand, the Spain that seemed that it was going to rule the world, rejected the gospel, and it sank through countless conflicts. It sank into abysmal depths of darkness, superstition, enslavement, impoverishment. That to this day, it's finding a great deal of difficulty climbing out of. And I think the saddest one of all is France. France gave us John Calvin. And under God, John Calvin gave us most of the political and social freedom we enjoy today. France gave us the Huguenots, as you mispronounce them. What a bunch of people they were. France expelled them. France rejected the gospel. If you just, I can suggest it for your study, but if you just take the time and see where the Huguenots went, see where they went. And everywhere they went, they enriched that country. They blessed that country. They were some of the greatest minds and craftsmen and merchants. In the whole world, they were a blessing wherever they went. And France, from being such a power, bathed Europe in blood, reached its zenith in the days of the Emperor Napoleon, the Corsican corporal who ultimately held Europe to ransom, sank into the awful troubles of the French Revolution. Now there's a contrast. England received the gospel. France rejected it. When France was going through its bloody revolution, England was safe. Why? Because God had visited it with the revivals under Whitfield and Wesley. It wasn't England's superior political system that kept it safe. It was the power of the gospel of Jesus Christ. That's the force that succeeded. My friend, that's what we need. America's not going to be safe because of who's in the White House. Now, I'm not indifferent to who's in the White House, but that's not what's going to save America. America's not going to be safe because of the political or economic doctrine that's prevailing at a given time. Though, again, we are not indifferent to those doctrines. But I tell you tonight, my friend, what will bring true safety and true greatness again to this country is what brought it safety and greatness to begin with. It is the force that really succeeds, the force and the power of the gospel of Jesus Christ preached in the fullness of revival blessing. May God grant it to us, and may we live to see the outpouring of the Spirit in a way even greater than the reformers in Europe ever witnessed. Let's bow our heads in prayer. Let's all pray.